From KUER News in Salt Lake City, this is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. The science writer Mary Roach begins her latest book this way. To the rocket scientist, you are the problem. By you, she means you, the human body, you and your puny memory, an odd frame and fluctuating metabolism. Most of the other elements in space travel are stable for the most part, but trying to design around the human body, that's the challenge. And for Roach, that's the part that's most interesting about the human adventure in space. Today in the program, Mary Roach is joining us to talk about her latest exploration. The book gets at the questions we've all asked, but at the center, Roach wants to know what space teaches us about being human. Packing for Mars, after the news. This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Let's be honest, when you're talking about everyday life in outer space, one of the first questions that comes to mind is, how do you, go to the bathroom? Well, it's not a trivial question when you think about the mechanics of the experience and the problem with gravity, or the lack of it, in space. For the science writer Mary Roach, this drives home the essence of her latest book, just how different everything is in space. In the past, Roach has focused on the afterlife, on dead bodies and sex. Now she's taking on what she calls the human and sometimes absurd struggles of life in space. The book is not just about the mundane moments of this experience, but what space exploration teaches us about being human. Her book is called Packing for Mars, The Curious Science of Life in the Void. Mary Roach has written four books, including Stiff and Bonk. She's also written for publications like Salon, Vogue, and the New York Times Magazine. She's joining us today from her home in Oakland, California. And Mary Roach, welcome to the program. Thanks very much for being with us.
Thanks for having me on.
I wanted to begin with asking you about your, I don't know if affection for space is the way to put it. You confess to being a closet space geek, though. Were you fascinated when you were younger?
No, this is something that developed later in life. I was actually one of the rare kids who, I was 10 years old when we landed on the moon, and I have no memory of that. I guess I was next door at the Balcher's house playing in the yard or blowing off firecrackers. I don't know what I was doing, but I have no memory. But later in life, I mean, as a science writer, I'd done a story out at Johnson Space Center, which really was, for me, sort of the magical kingdom. There's just so much cool stuff there that I got very geeked out, and I think that planted the seed for this book.
You know, one of the things I was thinking about was the Ames Research Center, and you write about this in the book, just the and we'll talk about the details as we go along, but the kind of think tank that Ames is, you write about that, and how in some ways they were kind of given this mandate, or at least it seems that way, to just go out and think about some of the craziest things you could think about, and the kind of creativity that must exist in a place like that.
Well, yeah, the creativity that goes, I mean, even going back to the 60s, not even just at Ames, but there, I remember I stumbled onto this amazing, the write-up of a conference. It was a conference on nutrition in space and related waste problems. This is 1964. We haven't even got to the moon, and yet people are thinking, well, right around the bend, we'll be heading to Mars, and how is that going to work? It's so far, and there's all these weight restrictions, and how will we launch all the food and water, and all these amazing proposals that people had, like, well, you could make the clothing edible, and when they're done wearing it, they could eat it, and then, you know, or parts of the spacecraft that you don't need, say, some of the maybe the landing module, whatever, make it out of edible proteins, eat that on the way home, or launch an obese astronaut. Someone actually had this idea that if you launched an obese astronaut, they'd worked out the caloric reserves and 50 pounds of fat and how long they could live off that. And that's just the kind of science I love, just way outside the box.
I guess in some ways this is kind of an homage to that kind of thinking, that the whole space program itself in all different countries, they're created by people like that who are thinking literally outside of the box.
Well, yeah, and they have to, because people take gravity for granted, but if you remove gravity from the equation, just about nothing on Earth works like it's supposed to, including the human body. So, name a body part, something's kind of weird about it in space. So everything that you try to do, whether it's eating or going to the bathroom, or you know, or it's particularly with the technology, all the technology has to be rethought. And that's why the space program, they always talk about all the benefits, the technologies that come out of it, because you are forced to rethink everything. Because you got no air, you got no gravity. It's just a real challenge in terms of making people comfortable, healthy, happy up there.
Mm. You've talked a little bit about the struggle of trying to sort of crack into this. I don't know if it's almost like it's this privileged elite society, getting into NASA, getting into talk to some of these people. It wasn't easy to get in there.
No, I the first time I interviewed an astronaut was for a Discover magazine story, and no exaggeration, it was more of a challenge to get to score an interview with an astronaut and get it set up. It was harder than scoring an interview with Tom Cruise, which was, you know, around that time I was doing some celebrity stories as well. The hardest, you know, we'd be like, well, you get to be here, and somewhere in this 48-hour window, we will call you, and you'll go to this room, and you'll talk to him. It was a very elaborate kind of process that I went through. And even now, for this book, you would, even for a phone interview, you had to fill out a little application. What are you, you know, what's the publication and what will you be talking about? And you would submit that, and then they'd get back to you. And then you call a special phone number, and it was a whole sort of elaborate process.
I like how you talk about the first astronaut you met. That there was this moment, I don't know, it was kind of this epiphany where you figured, I guess you were expecting, you know, the iconic image of the astronaut. And at some point you figure, wow, he's kind of ordinary. He's a human being.
Yeah, I was this. I didn't. Because you expect when you walk into Building 9, which is this building at Johnson Space Center with all the mock-ups and all, and there's usually an astronaut somewhere wandering around the floor doing something, because they're involved a lot with the planning of space missions. They're not just up in space. And so, but you can't. You think that you'll be able to tell who an astronaut is because of Apollo and because of the mythology. You sort of expect them in the big bulky suit with their life support suitcase in their hand, kind of lumbering,
right,
you know, sort of in this macho manner. And I met this astronaut, and, you know, he was wearing, his name was Lemur, and he was a really nice guy. He was wearing a Hawaiian shirt and chinos and brown shoes, and he had glasses, and he was a little, you know, he had a little bit overweight, not much, but just like and I just had this thought, oh my God, they're just people. You would think I would know that, but much more so than, you know, meeting a celebrity or something like that. It was just this sense that somehow, because of those visors they always used to wear in space, and you never really saw the human side. It was a human form, but kind of puffed up and larger than life.
It's interesting. You, I think I read somewhere where you said you almost scrapped the project. It was so hard to find people to talk to or find your way in.
Well, yeah, it was tough for me because, me being me, I'm interested in not, I don't have the same interests that the public relations people do. They were very nice. They were as helpful as they could be. There's a lot of rules regarding, you know, astronauts get a lot of media requests, and the public affairs people try to protect their privacy a bit. And also people just, you know, when I call up and say, when the shuttle first comes down after 2 weeks in space, I'm really interested in the hygiene compromises. I just want to get a whiff of that. Can I just go up and smell the shuttle? They're like, this makes people uncomfortable. The kind of things that I want. They're like, well, why do you want that?
Yeah.
Well, I don't know. Read my book. You'll see you'll see the kinds of things I do. But I think that it was tough. I had a couple. There was a moment where something I'd set up at the Japanese Space Agency was threatening to fall through, and then there was a cadaver test that NASA was doing. And NASA, you know, as a government agency, they're uncomfortable with things that, you know, they might lose support, which means losing funding, and so they're very cautious. And having somebody there for a cadaver, something involving a cadaver, just made them uncomfortable.
Yeah. What were the questions that you were thinking about early on? Like, what were the things? These are the things I want to know as I embark on this project or try to figure out. Did you have some particular questions in mind, and were they kind of mundane? Like, how do you use the bathroom? How do you have sex in space?
Well, I knew that I wanted to cover those because I cover that's the kind of stuff I love. I'm kind of the science writer who covers the things that fall through the cracks or the things that no one else no one else thinks to ask or feels comfortable asking, I guess.
Yeah.
So, yes, I knew that I would have the definitive toilet in space chapter. I mean, I really took it to a new level. I'm pretty proud of myself. But, yeah, I knew it. But here's the amazing thing. NASA, for that, that particular aspect of it, they were very welcoming. They said, you can come to the shuttle toilet training room. And, yeah, that's fine. You can try out the equipment. There's the positional trainer, which was a truly astounding piece of technology, where you're it's a toilet bowl, not a functioning toilet. It's got a video camera pointing up, and you sit on that. And then on the wall beside you is the closed-circuit television system, so you see the view of that camera. So, I mean, it's a view you don't really want to have of yourself,
right.
I can tell you now. But the... And it's to make sure your angle is right. You've got to, it's a much smaller hole opening, and if your angle is off, because you're not sitting in space, you're hovering anyway. It's a little tricky to get positioned properly, so you practice a little bit on Earth. As with most things in space, it helps to practice it on Earth. So, but anyway, NASA was particularly, they were fine with that, which I didn't really expect. So some things are okay with, other things are not. So it was a bit of a rocky road, but honestly, all my books are.
Yeah. You know, there was this kind of tidbit that I caught in the book that I wanted to ask you about, because it seems to get at, in some ways, the kind of things you're interested in. You tell this, just briefly mention Yuri Gagarin, the Russian cosmonaut. You talk about how he tells about walking the red carpet after his adventure in space, noticing his shoelace was undone. And that he could think of nothing else. I mean, he's being, you know, fed by the rest
thousands
of the world.
Thousands of people lining the walkway. This, you know, from it was as he came off the plane.
Yeah.
This red carpet and laid out, and then he's before the presidium of the committee of the Soviet, the Soviet Union Communist Party, and just this unbelievable moment. He's being feted as the first man in space, and he looks down and his shoe is untied, and that's all he can think about. And I just love. Because these people are human beings. You know, it's bringing it back again to the fact that they're just people. The other moment like that I love is Charlie Duke on the moon with his in-suit drink bag with the Tang, and it's leaking.
Yeah.
So here he is. It's just the most amazing moment, the pinnacle of his career on the moon, and just his hair is soaked with Tang. There's Tang all over his visor. And that's all, of course, he can think about is the mess inside his helmet, and why can't whose fault is this?
Yeah.
I just love that moment.
What do you love about it, though? I mean, what do you love about those odd little?
Space, sending a human being, a tiny little human being, into the infinite reach of space. There's sort of a hubris to it, and it makes the astronaut, the person who's up there, it gives them this larger than life. They become iconic. They become mythologized in this way that they've got. No, they're still the same person up there. You know, there's nothing different about them, and their humanness comes through amidst all of the glory. You know, and the moments that are cherry picked by NASA to give to the public. You know, but if you read the transcripts, and there's like 400 or 500 pages of each mission, these wonderful just moments of humanity come through, because inside that spacesuit is just the regular guy or gal.
Mm. You know, it's interesting. I mean, aside from the science, it's all built around these little stories. I guess that's the way in. That's what all good journalists do, is they just find the stories to give the bigger picture, I guess.
Well, for me, science writing is I always want to have a narrative. Each chapter, a story and some characters to pull people in and make it a little more accessible and interesting. And then the science, you present the science in the context of a story, the science is always interesting, but somehow it's a little more interesting when it's presented in that way, I think.
You know, you've been doing interviews for the book now for several weeks. What are you learning about the kinds of questions you're getting in these interviews, about what people are interested in, what they want to know about the experience?
Well, of course, people are... The thing that the astronauts all say has been verified, which is that the number one question is, how do you go to the bathroom in space?
Yeah.
But the other thing that people are fascinated by is the psychological side of it. You know, particularly with a Mars mission, which would be close to 3 years, people just imagine, and now with the Chilean miners also, that's why I've been getting questions, people interviewing me about in that context, just the notion of being trapped in this very small space with people that you didn't choose to be with. People can't wrap their heads around that, want to know, how do you cope with that? What happens when things go wrong? And what would it be like on a Mars mission? So that's been a source of fascination for people.
It must have made you sort of cast back to the 60s and the days before we actually send anyone up. Now we take that experience for granted, I think, maybe in some ways, but there was a lot of anxiety in those days about all of those very, very particular questions.
Yeah, there was this amazing period of hand-wringing and fretting and, like, what will happen physically to a human being without gravity, because nobody knew. And gravity is one of the fundamental forces of the universe. It's a pretty scary concept. If you don't have any sense of what might happen, there were scientists and biologists thinking who thought that things would happen, like the blood would just churn in place, that the heart wouldn't really move it through the circulatory system, that the eyeball would change shape so radically that you wouldn't be able to see, that the vestibular system would not just, nausea, yeah, that does happen, but they thought, well, you would just be incapacitated. It would just be this frenzy in your head. They thought that psychologically there might be this syndrome, similar to what, around that era, solo pilots, particularly in high-altitude flights, would have sometimes this experience of invincibility and wanting to fly on and on and feeling that they were like gods. And there was a fear that the first astronauts would just lose their minds and do something rash. Yuri Gagarin couldn't control the capsule. In an emergency, he was given an envelope with instructions on what to do, how to take control of it, but it was controlled from the ground because there was this... it was an unknown. What's going to happen to it? It's just this infinite black space, and he's the first man up there, and what's going to happen to him? So there was just an amazing amount of work done here, in simulators, and, you can simulate weightlessness for 20 seconds at a time by, flying a plane and kind of a roller coaster up and down pattern. So all kinds of, we're going to try eating. Now we're going to see if you can go to the bathroom in space. Now we're going to, it's just every aspect of being human had to be tried in a simulator here. There was a sort of, we tiptoed into space.
Mary Roach is with us. Her book is called Packing for Mars, The Curious Science of Life in the Void. We'll take a brief break. Back in a moment. This is Radio West on KUER and Sirius XM Public Radio. This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. When you've written about the science behind the human cadaver and the afterlife and sex, what's your follow-up? Today on the program, Mary Roach is with us to talk about her latest project, The Human Struggles of Life in Outer Space. Packing for Mars is the name of her book, The Curious Science of Life in the Void. Mary Roach, I wanted to ask you about the right stuff, what it takes, what it took then, what it takes now. You compare the way America's first astronauts sort of were selected to the way they're chosen today. I mean, in the 60s, on some level, it was about charisma and virility. It's kind of different now.
Yeah, the right stuff was particular to those early days where it was a very short mission, one brave man going where no one had gone or very few people had gone, very risky. You really needed a brave, aggressive, fearless, macho fighter pilot kind of dude, and that's what we had. That today is the wrong stuff, because you're looking at missions that are 2 weeks to 6 months or more, and five or six people in a small confined space. So now the recommended astronaut attributes are things like flexibility, fairness, ability to form stable and quality interpersonal relationships,
right,
sense of humor. You really don't want a large ego in a small room. Not good. So it's really, it's come 180 degrees from what it was back in the 60s and in before.
You write about how Japan chooses its newest astronauts. And among the tasks they're asked to do is make paper cranes.
Yeah, I was in the Japanese Aerospace Exploration Agency was choosing a new astronaut, and they had the 10 finalists in an isolation chamber, and they were psychologists and psychiatrists watching them. And the day that I was there, they had them, they passed around envelopes, and they opened up these envelopes, brought out sheafs of colored paper, which I recognized from my childhood as origami paper. And indeed, the test was called 1,000 cranes, and each astronaut candidate or applicant had to do 100 cranes, and they were strung along on a piece of string and given to the psychologist. It was kind of forensic origami. Mm-hmm. And what they were looking at, it actually made sense given what we were just talking about, how space has changed and the things that you need to be good at have changed. Space is a place, you're out on a spacewalk and you're tightening a series of bolts. I mean, it's a repetitive chore, and you can't be the kind of person whose attention wavers. You need to be very accurate, and you need to have attention to detail. You need to be very patient and not flip out if you have a clock ticking, which you do in space. You have a limited supply of oxygen. You can only be out there so long, and you got to get the tasks done. So really, doing 100 cranes and then having somebody look at how did the first cranes compare to the last, you know, does this person get sloppy, was kind of a appropriate and brilliant little test, I thought.
This is kind of an elegant test also in they took away, they fed this group, and then they took away their meals, yes. The kind of paper boxes or whatever they were with their meals, and they photographed the condition in which they had left their discarded meals.
Yes, they looked at each candidate had put their dirty dishes into a box, and they looked at how they had piled them into the box. They took photographs, and these again went to the psychologists to look at. And I guess in that case, they were looking at. Yeah, I think you can sort of, it's sort of a Rorschach kind of a personality test. How do you stack your dishes? Certainly, if you looked at the way I stack my dishes, probably would not send me into space. not how you would. It's difficult to picture John Glenn actually being tested in these ways.
Yeah. Well, you yourself applied to be a subject in a simulated Mars mission, and you talk about how you had made the first round of cuts, and then what you figure anyway was this test is you'd gotten this really early phone call, super early in the morning.
Yeah, there was a mock Mars mission going on right now called Mars 500, and I had applied to be in the run up, which was 3 months, just to figure out the logistics and how things were going to work, and I thought maybe I could endure that, and it would be interesting for the book. And I made it to the first round, and then they said, well, we'll be calling you. Well, the call came, as you said, 3:30, 4 in the morning, and I'm not a morning person, and I didn't take care to hide my irritation when they called. And I answered their questions, but, you know, of course I was sort of, on the West Coast. Maybe you didn't realize it's 4 in the morning.
Yeah, yeah.
And that was part of the test. So I did not make it to the next round because if you're an astronaut or a simulated astronaut, you have to be somebody who's A-okay with being woken up at all hours and asked to do whatever. You just have to be somebody who's used to inconvenience, taking orders, doing something that you don't feel like doing. So you won't be seeing me on a Mars mission anytime soon.
I'm interested in that difference, that relationship between simulation and reality, because you write about how our culture, more and more people live through simulations now, and you say in some ways it's kind of like it has become the new reality, but you say really it isn't anything like the real thing, simulation in some ways.
No, it isn't, and that was something that the astronauts, I spoke to cosmonauts about the Mars 500 project, and they said, it's a joke to them. The notion that it in any way simulates what it's like to be in space. This particular cosmonaut said, "I within the first minute of being in space, I realized all of my training hadn't prepared me for it. It was completely different. It's much harder. It's hotter. It's dirtier. It's just not something you can ever imagine when you're on Earth. Partly what the simulations are what they're trying to do is, you know, test technologies. In the case of Mars 500, they're looking at, there's software that could do facial pattern recognition to see if you could detect stress on someone's face if they're not going to tell you about it. Because one thing about astronauts is they're not keen to share their inner feelings if they feel like it's going to compromise their ability to be assigned on another mission. So they tend to not be very forthcoming with psychological turmoil, and then you have situations like the Lisa Nowak problem, you know, the woman who confronted her love rival with the mace and, you know, that whole mess. So they were looking at, you know, it wasn't so much that they themselves believed this is exact replica of space, but it is a stressful, isolated confinement situation, and let's look at ways to avert problems that are, you know, building up, look at ways of keeping tabs on the people in the small space and maybe figure out how to deal with it.
I'm not sure if you put it in, categorize it like this, but I'm wondering, what do you figure was the most interesting as you were working along, the physical effects or the psychological ones? Because they're both pretty profound.
They are pretty profound. I mean, since we're on the topic of isolation and confinement, being in a box with other people, that was interesting to me. It was explained to me, it's a very, very frustrating environment because you don't have any control. You're stuck. You're soaking in it. You can't just, you know, slam the door and go out for a drive. Mm. So the frustration turns to anger. You just have this supply of anger, and anger wants an outlet.
Yeah.
And if you're in space, you don't take that out on your crew members because it makes the situation worse, and you depend on these people for your survival. So what happens is something called displacement, where you get really, really grumpy with mission control or the nutritionist, or it's just somebody that's just irritating you. You kind of put it on them. And the third thing you can do with your anger is to turn it inward, to suppress it, and then you have depression, and that's a big concern, particularly for a Mars mission in particular. Depression and the tedium contributes to that as well, boredom, tedium. So that's, I think, the biggest. And I wouldn't worry so much about people, you know, murdering each other. I think people will turn it inward, and that'll be it'll take a toll on them. I interviewed this cosmonaut, Alexander Levakin, about he spent 6 months on Mir, and I said, well, how did you handle the frustration? And, you know, he was one of those people who turned it inward. He said, I did get depressed. He said, Mary, there were days when I wanted to hang myself, but of course, in zero gravity, you can't. It's just one of those classic cosmonaut lines.
I guess that surprised me, I have to say. It must have surprised you in some way to find out that you could actually be bored in space. I mean, you would think it would be the most stimulating kind of environment, and it is at times, but it's not at times also.
No, there's this line in Eugene Cernan's memoir. He was Apollo 17, the last Apollo moon mission. Hmm. He says, funny thing happened on the way to the moon. Not much. Should have brought some crossword puzzles. Hmm. I mean, that just blew my mind, that you could be... you're heading to the moon. You're one of the first, you know, how many people had been on walked on the moon before him? I mean, single digits, I think. It was just incredible that could be a boring scenario. But I think, there's just nothing, there's not a lot to do. You're essentially a projectile shot toward the moon. You know, there's not a whole lot of steering that goes on or piloting that has to be done until you get closer to the moon. So, not a lot of recreational opportunities, so pretty quickly it gets boring. But yeah, that was a huge surprise to me.
What's it like on the space station? Do you have a sense of that? You described the sleep chambers, for example, as they're kind of like sleeping in phone booths.
Well, and on the shuttle, there's not even any kind of a booth.
Yeah.
I mean, it's almost like bivouacking on a, you know, as a mountain climber sort of hooks into a wall. You snap your sleeping sack to the wall. And you don't have you actually don't have a private space at all. You have a bag that you sleep in, and a place to store your personal belongings. But you don't have your own room. On a Mars mission, they would have each astronaut would have a small, probably similar to, you know, on a train, like on an Amtrak train, a little tiny space that you would have to yourself. I think that they've recognized that that's important for privacy. They learned that from submarines. There's a procedure called hot bunking, where people share a bunk and you don't ever have your own space that nobody else can go into, and that's considered to be just not fair. So they try to avoid that. They try to give everyone their own territory, no matter how small, just a space that is considered your own and nobody else can come into it. And so I think that for a Mars mission, that would absolutely be something they would do.
There's this there's this experience that it seems like you absolutely could not simulate, even for 20 seconds on Earth, and that's this experience that they call the breakaway effect, this feeling that these astronauts report of this kind of, I don't even know how you describe it, kind of this detachment from the Earth when they're up there. How do you describe it? How do you explain
what
that is?
Well, there are two phenomena. Well, one is the breakaway phenomenon. That was something that happened with test pilots in the early days when they would, on solo flights, where they would feel invincible, that they could just fly on and on. But there's also, which is less of a concern now because, you know, it's so many years later and it doesn't seem to have been a problem. And with a larger crew, you don't get that. But the thing that people talk about now, which is impossible to simulate, is Earth out of view phenomenon, and that is when we go to Mars, if and when, this will be the first time that human beings have been so far from home that they can't even see the Earth. Astronauts now have, you know, they can stare down at this huge, you know, lovely blue orb, and that won't be the case. You won't even see the home planet. And there's a fear among psychologists, space psychologists, that as the Earth disappears, so will all of the moral structures, and that there'll sort of be a breakdown of the moral fabric inside the spacecraft, and perhaps somebody will kill someone, or you know, whatever. Who knows what the result of that will be? But that's something that you hear discussed, and that is something. Yeah, there isn't any way to simulate that.
Mm. I wanted to ask you a little bit about that, the sense of euphoria part of the breakaway effect, that early one that hasn't become quite the problem, because there's a really interesting story. Ed White, NASA's first spacewalk, Gemini 4, and it's such a great story because it seems like NASA is so terrified that Ed White will not come back in. It's such an ecstatic experience being in space.
Well, they had been concerned about, you know, the breakaway effect, or that were being negative consequences, or that once he got out there, just being in this infinite blackness would sort of be more than an astronaut could handle. But as it turned out, it was both for him and for Alexei Leonov, the first astronaut, cosmonaut in this case, the first to walk in space, and Ed White was the second. Both of them had this euphoria, and they didn't want to come back in. Ed White, if you read that mission transcript, it's remarkable. Yeah. He's just McDivitt, his crewmate, is saying, "You got to come back in now. They want you to come back in." And Ed White's going, "Oh yeah, I've taken pictures, and I've got one more shot. Oh, I've got a great shot, Ed. You've got to come back in now.
Yeah.
Just one more. No, Ed, now." And he's like, he doesn't want to come in. Finally, he agrees, and he says, "This is the saddest moment of my entire life."
Mm.
You know, it's like a kid who doesn't want to stop what he's doing and come downstairs for dinner. He just didn't want to come back in.
It's such a great story from and something like that, as you say, probably wouldn't happen again. I mean, one of the big fears then, of course, was what would you do if someone got they ran out of oxygen, they passed out. I mean, it was too risky to get them back in through the hatch.
Right.
And there was a procedure where you would just cut them loose.
And Ed White, in fact, it took 25 minutes to get him back in the capsule. It didn't go as planned. Mm. And there, it was quite a struggle. And you read the transcript, there's just this long blank. There's just nobody saying anything. And it's 25 minutes later, and he's finally back in. But it was a really scary thing. It's not, you're wearing a pressure suit. It's a very bulky, it moves in certain ways and certain ways only.
Yeah.
And, you know, if you get stuck, one of the cosmonauts did get stuck and nearly died, and you can't pull the person back in if they're unconscious. I mean, even when they're conscious, it's hard to maneuver through a hatch. So the protocol would be to cut him loose. But it's all, you know, that would be akin to burial at sea for a sailor. It would be probably not a negative thing to an astronaut to die in space. Probably there would be some nobility to that, the burial in space.
Yeah. Mary Roach is with us. Her book, Packing for Mars, The Curious Science of Life in the Void. We'll take another brief break. Back in a moment. You're listening to Radio West on KUER and Sirius XM Public Radio.
Mm-hmm.
This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Back now with Mary Roach. Her latest book is called Packing for Mars, The Curious Science of Life in the Void. I wanted to ask you about gravity, because one of the forces of gravity, it's a critical part of the way we have to think about all of this. Researching the book, you say, gave you kind of a deeper understanding of what you call, the gravitas of gravity. And I hadn't thought about it, but it's such a critical way of thinking about all of this.
Oh, yeah, gravity. I mean, even something as simple, I'll use the example of something everybody takes for granted, the burp. Okay, in zero gravity, in space, it doesn't work right. And there was this wonderful story about Coke and Pepsi had spent $500,000 coming up with a zero-gravity carbonation system. Because carbonation doesn't work very well. It doesn't work at all because the bubbles don't rise to the surface of the beverage. They just sort of froth around in the middle. So they worked out a way to make carbonation happen in zero gravity without thinking through, well, what happens to those little bubbles in the human stomach? Well, they don't rise to the top where the opening is. So if you try to burp, you get sort of one of those messy burps. So just like a little detail like that can have fairly large consequences, at least for Coke and Pepsi. But every bodily system depends in one way or another on gravity, and things begin to change. And that's one of the biggest hurdles when it comes to a Mars mission is the long-term changes in the human body because of gravity. We evolved for life with gravity, a specific amount of gravity. And when you change that, everything changes. If we went to a huge planet with much, much more gravity, then we'd be just pinned to the surface. Yeah. We couldn't move. So really, we've evolved not just for the climate and the atmosphere and everything on Earth, but also the specific gravity of Earth.
It's interesting. I mean, you talk about how our bodies are taller in space, how we're constantly shedding fluid. It has effects on our bone mass. I mean, this can't be good for us in the long run.
Well, if we were going to stay in space forever, we would be fine. It's the problem happens when you come back to Earth, or if you landed on a planet with gravity, now you've lost muscle because of atrophy. You're more like a fish in space. You're just floating around. You don't need all these muscles, and you don't need all these limbs and this skeletal system that evolved to get you from one place to another by walking. You don't need any of it, and your body starts to dismantle it. And if we were just to stay up there, that'd be fine. But when you come down, then you get into a bit of trouble. You have to readjust, and the vestibular system has to readjust. Astronauts get what they call Earth sickness, whereas you've adapted. You've finally gotten used to zero gravity. You're feeling better. You're not throwing up anymore, and you're great. And then you come back to Earth, and you have to completely readjust. If you're an astronaut, you've been up there 6 months on the space station, you don't head straight for the press conference because you'd be throwing up and falling over. You're in the medical area, and you're taking baby steps and really readjusting to the feel of moving your limbs. This one astronaut, Andy Thomas, said to me, a leg is a very heavy thing, and you don't think about that when you've been in zero gravity. You come back, and your legs feel like cement.
I had no idea how extensive the gravity, the role it played on your, frankly, on your bladder. I mean, you talk about how these astronauts have to almost be toilet trained.
Yeah, the bladder works because of stretch receptors. This is how you know that you need to make a visit to the bathroom. The fluid builds up on the floor of the bladder and begins to activate these stretch receptors. Well, in zero gravity, the fluid doesn't build up on the floor. It clings by surface tension all around the organ. So by the time you get those stretch receptors letting your brain know, the bladder is so full that it may be pressing the urethra closed partly, and you might need to be catheterized. And so you have a minor medical situation there, that all because of gravity. Yeah.
Talk about the sensation of free falling in space. This is something that you can sort of simulate it. I mean, you did it. You went up in one of these airplanes that simulates for 20 seconds at a time the experience of zero
right.
gravity, or near zero gravity anyway.
Well, yeah, but the terror comes when you get outside of the confined space, because when you're in a spacecraft or you're in a simulator, which is one of those jets that's doing up and down roller coaster pattern, you're inside, you're falling with the craft.
Right.
So you just feel like you're floating. you don't have a sensation of falling. But when you're an astronaut and you go outside the spacecraft to do work on the exterior, to whatever it is that you're doing, repairs or installing a module or whatever, and you suddenly look down at the Earth, now you have the sensation that you are falling at 17,000 miles per hour toward Earth, and you are. So, it can be a debilitating fear for astronauts. They'll try to position themselves so that they're not seeing, the Earth speeding by, so that they'll just be looking into the blackness or into space and not have that sensation. But it can be a crippling fear.
Mm. You write about the experience of feeling those 20 seconds at a time. It must be something like what it's like to take heroin. You have never taken heroin, and people have written that. It's interesting. People got confused about the way you wrote about it. Yeah, but anyway, once you feel it, all you can think about is how much you want to do it again.
Yes, that is how I was surmising that it must be like heroin. It was this, and I thought that it would be fairly similar to floating in water.
Sure.
But it isn't, because with water you feel this substance buoying you and you feel the resistance against your arms when you move them. But here, in this case, you weigh the same as the air. You weigh like a soap bubble. And you don't. And not only is that tremendously foreign and wonderful in its own surreal way, but there's also this, you don't realize that your organs inside you have a weight, and that weight confers a sensation. And when that disappears, you feel unburdened of a weight that you didn't know you had. And so you feel just infinitely relaxed, and it is just, unless you're one of those poor people getting sick in the back of the plane, put them aside, but it is the most physically comfortable, delightful feeling you can imagine. It's just, and it's very, it comes on gently when the plane, you go from double gravity, and when the plane is pulling out and going back up to no gravity. And it doesn't just drop you. It just sort of lets you down gently. And then when you start to go over the top, you rise up off the floor of the plane, and you're floating. You're just like a little, like nothing. And then I highly recommend it. It is expensive to go on one of those. I'm not going to pay the $5,000 to go on a weightless flight. But it is something people can do commercially.
Astronauts talk about how that thrill does wear off, though.
That was a surprise to me, that weightlessness, that floating as a way of moving around the room could become annoying. But it makes sense, because you put something down, you can't let go of something or put it down, because it floats away, you'll never see it again. Sometimes they would talk about how you just want to be able to sit still and do your work, but you're always drifting. It's like being in a rowboat and trying to keep the rowboat still. You've got currents and wind, and sometimes they just and your hands float up and hit you in the face, and it can be an annoyance. Which, yes, it was hard for me, having only experienced it for a few minutes. Hard to imagine how it could be an annoyance.
What does it mean for eating, and not just the function of eating, which is a problem in of itself, I suppose, but that question that all of these scientists, before anyone went to space, they were puzzling about: what was it going to do to the heart? What was it going to do to the intestinal system? One of our listeners wants to know, what about the functions of loss of gravity on intestinal function, for example?
Right. Well, it turned out to not be a big... you have peristalsis, that sort of chorus line of muscular contractions that squeezes the food down into the stomach, and then the intestines will have a similar way of squeezing the food along. So that wasn't that wasn't as much of a concern as they thought. But what was the concern here was, it was more that on the other end of the digestive system, in the small capsules, there was no bathroom, there was no toilet. So the food, the way to deal with it on a short flight, the way to deal with the problems of waste control really was to constipate the astronaut. So the food was designed to be very, as they put it, low residue, no fiber, highly processed. They wanted them to be, they wanted to give them nutrients but not create a lot of waste, because it was so distasteful to, eliminate into a plastic bag that the food took on, one of the functions of the food was to keep the excreted material to a minimum. So as you can imagine, the food was not very much liked. Some of the astronauts just didn't eat. On a mission that was a couple days long, they didn't eat very much at all. And would not have to then go to the bathroom.
And then, of course, you get to the question of, all right, what if you're up there multiple days or even months?
Yeah.
And is it still a problem? You know, this question of, there was a point when you, this little tidbit where you write that over the course of 3 years, which is what it would take to get to Mars and back, I suppose, a four-person crew would generate somewhere in the neighborhood of 1,000 pounds of feces.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. But on a Mars mission, though, and this is, again, getting back to that thinking outside the box, hydrocarbons are good at shielding radiation,
right?
Cosmic radiation. So the thinking has been, for a Mars mission, one of the things suggested was that you would line the capsule on the way to Mars with your food, and then on the way back, when the food has been depleted, you would supplement with the feces.
Mm.
So you would use it as, obviously, there'd be some sort of technology to encase it, you know, in plastic, which is, they do that at Ames. It's kind of like an easy bake oven, I guess. Creates these little shingles that you would put all around the capsule to protect you. So they've got, you go to Mars, everything gets recycled one way or another.
But you know what's interesting about this part, though, of the book is what you say is that in space, and this is one of the things you say you love about it, is that it kind of forces you to rethink certain ideas about what is and what isn't acceptable.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, there's from the very beginning, just the notion of, well, you're going to be two guys sitting next to each other, and when you have to go to the bathroom, you'll have to do it in a plastic bag. I mean, that's sort of an unthinkable, like, oh, who could do that?
Yeah.
But really, for them, it's worth it for the prize at the bottom of the box. Okay, you know, they're Air Force guys. They're used to distasteful things and cramped quarters and being sort of in an intimate environment with another guy. They deal with it. And someone tells them now, okay, we're putting a rig on the International Space Station. It'll be recycling urine. We'll be drinking urine. All right, that's what it takes to be an astronaut. No big deal. It's a psychological problem. It's not a physiological problem. Drinking one's own urine, if it's been purified, if it's been filtered, and the salt's been removed, not a big deal. It's a big deal psychologically, but get over it. You know, it's not. It's something we can all do, and hopefully we won't one day all have to be drinking our own urine. But with the way the environment and global warming and water supplies are, it's maybe not such a bad thing to start getting used to.
And you wonder about whether this is this new way of thinking about all this is, as you say, a collapse of human dignity or just a unique new form of intimacy.
Yeah. I think we underestimate our ability to adapt to things that at first seem wrong or distasteful, or you sort of sit down and you think, well, why is it wrong? Why is it distasteful? Mm. Maybe it's not that bad. Maybe it's no big deal.
You say in the book that the tougher question isn't whether it's possible to go to Mars, but whether it's worth it to go to Mars. Do you think in doing all this research, have you come to your own kind of conclusion about that? And how is the question playing out as you're seeing it?
I would love to see a Mars mission with human beings on it. I should say. Everybody says manned, but then people say it's not just men.
Yeah.
Anyway, I'd love to see a mission to Mars that sends human astronauts. I would love it to be a global, international cooperative mission in the same way that the International Space Station has been for 10 years, sort of an exercise in global space cooperation. Mm. That way it's not as much of a financial burden on each country. I think we can address the physiological challenges and psychological challenges. I think that's something space agencies can do, and in not the not that distant future. People say, well, it's so expensive. If somebody were to say to me, all right, we're going to take this money that you're going to spend on Mars, and if you tell me you will use that money to eradicate cancer, to improve the educational system, to deal with poverty, if you can guarantee me that the money will be spent there, then I would say don't spend it on a Mars mission. But that's never how it works. It's always squandered on something. So let's squander it on a Mars mission is how I feel. And I also think that the technology that would come out of thinking outside of the box to such a degree as would have to happen with a Mars mission, I think you would see all kinds of benefits to people on Earth. So I'm all for it.
Let me ask you this finally. One of the people you talked to said about all of the challenges of being in space and getting it in space, that the life of an astronaut is either the best job in the world or the worst job in the world. Do you have a better understanding of why they do it, why they put themselves through it to do this?
Yeah, I understand it as some, you know, as somebody who loves to go backpacking, which is like space, compromised hygiene, sleeping on the ground, dealing with, I mean, it's very uncomfortable and inconvenient, but it's so worth it for being there in this place that so few people have been, seeing the views that you see. I think space is that times a thousand. And for certain people, people who want to be astronauts, who are driven to explore, to be in space, the inconveniences don't, they hardly even enter into the equation. I mean, for me, space, you know, Mars mission, no thanks. Send me to the moon. Mm. I'd love to do that. But there are people who would go today on a one-way mission and be absolutely thrilled to do it. So, and I guess I do understand, you know, from my limited experience as a backpacker, I do understand how the inconveniences just don't really matter. You know, it's worth it just for the thrill and the surrealness of being where you get to and what that's like. And it's kind of hard to explain to somebody who doesn't have that desire, who really wants a good cup of coffee in the morning.
Mary Roach, her book is called Packing for Mars, The Curious Science of Life in the Void. Thanks very much for joining us, Mary.
Thanks, Doug.
Radio West, a production of KUER News, the program produced by Elaine Clark. I'm Doug Fabrizio.